And it's time now for Night Shift.
Now, where are my people? 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 Where are my people?
Hi, I'm Billy D. Williams for WBAI listener-sponsored radio. You're listening to Night Shift, where life is like science fiction.
Was the kind of world we'd made. 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 World we'd made.
World and you are tuned world we'd made. To Night Shift. World we'd made. World we'd made. And it's time. It is Monday, July 17th, 2023, and you are tuned to Night Shift. And we are going to talk about the way the world is right now. And I have a special co-host with me. Kelly, are you there?
Good evening. How are you all?
Good evening. All right, so I'm going to turn this down a little bit here so that I can hear you better. So, wow, I'm hearing myself. Hold on a second. I'm hearing an echo. You're hearing it too? All right. It should be gone now. Do you hear an echo now? No more echo. Okay. So, as I said, you are tuned to listener-sponsored radio, WBAI. This is Night Shift. I'm Mike Sargent. I'm here with Dr. Kelly Wright, who is a raciolinguist, and we'll find out more about what that means. If you haven't heard this show before, if you haven't heard her before, you haven't heard myself before, then just know that we will prove to you that life is like science fiction. So, you're aware of the agenda, Kelly, for this evening?
I am.
You are. And I think that you're also aware of what's happening on the planet right now.
At least a handful of things.
And I also think that you're aware that... All right, well, let's put it like this. The listeners don't know that I do have a theme for the show, and the theme is the language of protection, and the subtitle is How Language Evolves to Incorporate Advances in Society and Protects Its Citizens. And I know that's an interesting, perhaps, statement, or you're like, what do you mean by that statement? But I want to ask you, considering we're watching in real time right now, the negotiations, if you could call them that, as to what's going on with the strike. And it's all going to come down to the contract. It's all going to come down to the wording. It's all going to come down to compensation. But it's all about the words that can either destroy you or protect you. So I'm just curious, because you're someone who clearly knows the importance of words, what are your thoughts just on the language of protection, just overall, and words that are meant to protect you?
Sure. Well, my thoughts in general are, you know, we don't, as someone who like works for linguistic justice, so I, you know, I'm a linguist, I, you know, participate in the scientific study of language. I'm particularly interested in how the ways in which we use language are shaped or controlled by the bodies we're in. And so people are oppressed because of their bodies without opening their mouths at all, right? So part of what linguistic justice efforts are is to like encode existing policy or laws with more equitable language that just represents more people or is accessible to more people. So for example, like the Southern Poverty Law Center has an entire initiative to make like legal jargon accessible, to translate it into language where people can actually learn their rights. And so like that's, you know, a kind of like linguistic protectionism where we're taking language that exists in one form and changing it into another so like more people can have access to that knowledge. This is one example, but I could give you many.
No, well, I'm sure you could, and I'm glad you gave that example because I feel like specifically contracts, laws, things that are written in, you know, or addendums or as we have with the Constitution, amendments. Those are all things that evolve because society evolves, language evolves. And one of the things that I want to talk about is just how certain phrases and words are created specifically either to protect or to acknowledge that you're not being protected. So I just want to know your thoughts on that and just if it underscores in any way the power of language for you, because you said something that I wonder, I would love to get a definition. You said linguistic justice. Now, what does that mean exactly?
Sure. So, I mean, linguistic justice is like any other justice. It is like the, you know, the freedom from oppression. So most people's language use has not been entirely free. So linguistic justice in general, you know, works to provide opportunities for people to use language that's unconstrained, like actual free speech, which we spent 2 hours talking about. Another week, the best book on the subject is from April Baker Bell, and it focuses on the ways in which Black people in the American education system have had fewer opportunities even than foreign language speakers in the U.S. system. So people who speak Spanish or Chinese have federal protections for their language, whereas people who, you know, speak a dialect like African American language or Appalachian language, those people do not have protections in our federal system. So bringing that into balance is linguistic justice. Is that an illustrative example?
No, that's a very good example because, you know, there's so much I could say to that we would be doing another show. But I do want to ask you now just your thoughts on specifically because you, I know you wanted to talk about, there's a lot to talk about in regards to the strike, though. The theme here is just how language can protect us or how language, you know, either has to be created to protect us. But I want to know what your thoughts are as a writer yourself, as someone who consumes entertainment. Did you have some specific things you wanted to say, some thoughts? Oh, no, I thought you did.
I thought that was at the end.
Oh, okay, all right. It can't be. All right, so then we'll let people wait. We'll wait. We'll get there. So, all right, here's my other question now. The thing about laws, and I think as a person of color, very often the feeling is that a lot of laws are created, they're written, and this comes back to the you know, whether you want to call it legalese and making it more clear. I don't want to liken it to the Bible, but when something is not written so it's easily understood, then it's open for interpretation. So we talk about
this in linguistics as under-specification.
Under-specification.
Like, so okay, the more specific a law is, the more narrowly tailored, if you want to borrow legal jargon, the more narrowly tailored a law is, the harder it is to reinterpret over time because it's incredibly specific. Sometimes that specificity works in your favor. And it keeps a law sort of ironclad. Sometimes that specificity does not work in your favor. So if a law, you know, really specifically protects one thing or, you're charged with a crime under very specific circumstances, then, you know, sometimes we can't charge people with crimes or sometimes we can't, you know, protect, or it doesn't protect everyone. So a lot of the things that unions do, you know, is look at their contracts and say, you know, there's air here. These protections are not specific enough, and we need them to be more specific because they've been underspecified. You know, so this idea of like, you'll be compensated, you know, or having like a verbal agreement for work is something that maybe isn't enshrined in the contract. It's like expanding that language and making it more specific makes it easier to protect people. But our law, our constitution, again, like in the free speech episode, our speech is protected in the constitution by just a clause. It's just a part of a sentence. It's not even a whole sentence. And so this right that we feel is, you know, innate and primary is protected by four words.
Well, that also brings into, you know, the quote unquote right to bear arms is also, you know, not very specific, even when you read the entire passage. So now, let me just say, I mean,
and yeah, more specific than the protections for speech.
Yeah, probably. Yes. Well, actually, yeah, you're right. So I guess just moving into
that whole shall not be infringed thing definitely isn't in our rights to fight the government.
Sorry. No. Well, a couple of topics I wanted to talk about with you, because we'll come back to the what they're calling the existential fight of SAG-AFTRA, because I do, life is like science fiction to me, and so my mind goes so many places. As a matter of fact, one of the things we'll talk about is Michael Crichton predicted a lot of what's going on with AI in a movie called Looker. Did you ever see Looker? Have you ever heard of Looker? All right, I'll play the trailer for you in a little while, and you'll see. This is like in 1981 he came up with this, but the hidden language of intent, and I would like to just get a little, because I am building to a few things here, so there's some context to what we're talking about. But the language of intent, you know, you say, you know, I was talking about how laws are written and they can be reinterpreted, and clearly they can be, you know, broken if you have enough money, but intent. What do you think? There's the intent of something, and then how it's used. Is there something linguistic for that? Where something is intended to be used one way, and then ends up being completely used another way. Not just a phrase, but just the language itself.
Yeah, I mean, absolutely. So, intent versus impact is at the core of our law in the US. So we often measure impact. So, and not intent. So for example, people who've been harassed, you know, they get to define like the severity of the action. So, you know, for some cases, like sending a picture could be harassment. Whereas in other cases, like something physical has to occur. That sort of thing is not defined by intent. You know, so somebody may have intended to send you a picture that was supposed to do X, Y, and Z, but you felt you were being harassed, right? That's like an impact is prioritized in those types of law. When we look at, and so like all personal injury claims, and then like all the way up to like torts, right? Like, so with corporate injury claims, right? Impact is prioritized. Linguistically, there's a model, it's called the affective with an A communication model. And essentially what that shows us is we really like lose control of our utterances the minute they leave our bodies. So I may have in my mind what I want to say and what I want other people to hear, but I have absolutely no control over how my utterances are received. The impact is much higher than the intent. The intent doesn't transfer. Right? It's just what I say that transfers. And so, you know, that's why like having a friend who like gets to know when you're being sarcastic is, you know, useful, because, you know, that intent comes through. And the affective model shows us like how sort of impact is calculated on the user side, like what all goes into somebody getting up in their feelings about what they hear or not.
What they feel you're saying, even that may not be what you're saying. So, well, you know, but let me ask you now, that incorporates actual human contact. But what about when it's a phrase or a law or something that is literally written with a certain intent, but then it goes on to be completely, like you said, the impact and let's just say misinterpreted. Is there a phrase for that, or is there something for that?
It's the same thing.
It's the same thing.
There's no difference between speech, writing, and sign. So they all work. Every part of every type of language works the same as every other type over time. So, you know, the intent in my speech, the intent in my writing, the intent in my gestures or my signed language, all of that, it's affective communication. It's, you know, this doesn't mean what it used to mean. So we interpret it in a different way. Or this doesn't mean to me what it meant when you wrote it down. That's essentially the relationship between art and the artist, right? So, I mean, it's an even bigger thing. It's like all of human perception prioritizes the person who's doing the perceiving, not what's being perceived.
Okay. Well, that leads me to the other thing, that the evolution of perspective, where, the simplest version would be like a phrase that's accepted at one time is no longer accepted. Like recently some, politician was talking about the colored people being in the military. And, but there are some people so, what the intent of that, what that meant at one time, has completely changed. So, I feel like there is something about, or clearly is this connection between what happens in society and then your perception or your perspective, and I guess the examples I'm thinking of course, is Reagan and how he was like a union leader when he was head of SAG. And then he became the union buster when he became the president, or LL Cool J, who was like a rapper and then a Republican. So, and that I have to assume is this perspective change, like your perspective changes, whether it's money or whatever. So what are your thoughts on that kind of a perspective change and how society or maybe language is involved? Or do you have any thoughts on that?
I mean, I feel like, we should leave room for each individual to experience personal growth. People are allowed to change, as they experience more things. So I feel like there's nothing linguistic that we can say, about Reagan or LL Cool J that is, makes them stand out from how any other person evolves in their lifetime, at least from my perspective. Now I think what's maybe interesting is like, the ways in which people who like look up to or value their perspectives maybe change or don't change, like have an opportunity to. So a lot of what I look at, I'm somebody who studies language use from the very first human being ever to use language, thousands of years ago and then to now, right? So in that amount of time, it really matters when you come on to the scene, right? So if you're born in 1550, right, the kinds of language that you use or the kinds of ideas that you've been exposed to are very different than if you're born in 2022. Then if you were born in 1981 and you like actually lived through this change versus if it's something that you just know about that's not actually part of your lifetime, the language that you use to refer to those times is very different. How you understand it's very different. So someone who, a major cult of personality, right, like comes in and starts changing the ways we use language, starts telling us that drugs are bad and unions are bad and, lots of things are bad. The poor, all of that. It's like, if that's the only thing you were ever exposed to, if that's the sea you're swimming in, like, do you know you're wet?
Well, that's the age we're living in many, many ways. People are just seeing the same information. So, again, it comes down to, I look at the industry of Hollywood as, I don't feel it's really, I think the technology's evolved, but I think the ethics have not really evolved, because we had a system where it was a studio system where no matter how successful the film was, the actors just got paid the same. And then that changed. And then when TV came along, you know, they had to fight to get the residuals for TV. And that's what, you know, Reagan was instrumental in happening. And then in the 60s and into the 70s, when syndication came along, you know, I'm sure you've heard, you hear stories like the woman who was on The Honeymooners, you know, The Honeymooners never got a dime. Alice never got a dime from all those reruns. The Star Trek actors never got any money until they started making movies. So I feel like it's the same sensibility just today. So it doesn't surprise me that streaming is just the new way for them. Now they got to fight for streaming. So just want to know if you had any thoughts on that one there.
Well, I do. I think that this, exactly what you just described, that these very particular protections, kind of that all our favorite actors and writers and, you know, associated crew are striking for, is it doesn't evolve on its own. You know, people had to actively push for those changes to happen. They had to examine the language. They had to have sufficient will. They had to organize. Every single step that you mentioned takes like a collective effort to change contract language. And that's what we see happening, you know, now again, like in its cycle, because honestly, this is one of the strongest unions in the country. Right. And so we know there is no type of change, no type of change, that happens in any other fashion. Right. So you have to have collective direct will for any type of change to happen. And so it really matters. It really matters that these individuals are going out and asserting like their perspective, asserting and demanding things. Like these are the, you know, the language of unions that people maybe shy away from or feel like I can't go in my boss's office and demand anything. Right. But it is like the collective and purposeful assertion, you know, of our rights in general that keeps them sustained. And so we see, you know, like Roe being overturned, and part of that, and part of people's anger with that is that they didn't elect the officials who did that. They didn't have an opportunity to, you know, assert their collective and direct will, even though, you know, they're screaming it as loud as they can. It has no effect because there's like no room for the voice of the people to be considered in those decisions. And so that's, yeah, it shows you like the, if an avenue for assertion is created, like in unions, then it can become like very directly effective, and we can look at exactly how it works.
Well, I have to say, I agree with you, and I was somewhat fascinated. I was doing some research for this show. By the way, we have a guest who's joined us here, Mike from Jersey.
Who is that? Oh, me?
Yes, you. Oh, yeah, you're the guest who just
joined. Wow. Okay.
Mike from Jersey, who is not really named Mike, and he's not really from Jersey.
No, neither of those things are true.
But you remember? Do you remember he was on once before with you, Kelly?
I do.
You do? Yeah, Mike from Jersey. You remember Doctor?
I certainly do. Hello, yes. Doctor.
Hello, Doctor. So, doing some research, you know, one of the things I came across was like this, and there's a whole website on it, definition of common labor terms. And I felt, perhaps as a linguist, because you probably saw some of these in advance, so I was kind of fascinated by these terms because they sound so surreal. And I'm glad you're here, Mike from Jersey. You might have seen some of these already. But okay.
I have, yes.
Yeah, okay. Alter ego employer. Okay. Now, it's like, what is that even? Alter ego employer. And it says an employer who changes the name and outward appearance of a business, but is in fact the same employer. An employer cannot rid himself of his obligation to recognize a legitimate bargaining representative through an alter ego. So that means that phrase had to be created because people's, you know, businesses were doing this kind of thing.
By the way, I've heard of the practice, obviously. I literally have never heard that term until you sent it to me earlier.
any thoughts there, Dr. Wright? I mean,
yeah, I mean, that's the thing. It's exactly what you said is like, you know, it's no different than when you like look on the Windex label and it's like, don't put the bottle in the oven. And you're like, okay, but the only reason why you had to tell me this is because somebody did it.
Right.
Yeah.
Exactly. So yeah. All right. Here's another one. Okay. And again, these words all together, what does this even mean? Okay. Area standards picketing. What is that? Okay, here it is. A form of picketing with the purpose of encouraging an employer to observe the standards in that industry, in that locality. This kind of picketing has formed legal restrictions than picketing to force an employer to recognize a union or to impress employees' non-economic benefits.
Here's the thing. If I put on my my spin doctor hat for a second, I feel like we can make that term better. I feel like it's so vague and weird, and it doesn't really.
It's what was the term you used?
Like it means
non-specific.
Nothing.
Isn't that what you said?
Underspecified.
Underspecified. There it is.
Yeah, okay. But it actually is like pretty specific.
It's pretty specific.
Yeah, it's like you're talking about standards in this area, like the area standards. Okay. The locality is like
very
that key phrase, which is, it's interesting. It's
all right.
It's interesting.
It is interesting. All right. Here's another one. Captive audience meeting. Okay. Exactly. You look up to the ceiling. A union term for meetings of workers called by management and held on company time and property. Usually the purpose of these meetings is try to persuade workers to vote against union representation.
Right. Yikes.
So that's a thing.
I've been in one of these meetings.
You've been in one of these meetings?
I have.
Wow. All right. And did you know it was a captive audience meeting?
I mean, yeah. It was, you know, we were like voluntold to go.
Yeah, there it is. All right, and here's the last one I'll give to you right now, because I've never even heard of this worm. This one, this is common situs picketing.
Never heard of it.
I never even heard of the word situs. Okay, it says a form of picketing which employees of a struck employer who work at a common site with employees of at least one neutral employer may picket only at their entrance to the worksite. The employees of neutral employers must enter the workplace through other gates. Picketing is restricted to the entrance of the struck employer so as not to encourage a secondary boycott on the part of the employees of a neutral employee.
Wow.
My head's going to explode.
This is common labor terms. It's common. This is what you do.
Yeah. I think it's C2. I think it's C2s. Okay. Because there's like two sites that they're referring to.
Yes.
A site for neutral employees and common C2s, which I don't know if you can make that plural that way.
Are these terms like intentionally elusive?
That's a real good question. I mean, to me, they're very I guess part of what I'm leading to here with you, Doctor, I don't know what to call it, Kelly, Dr. Wright. Sometimes I want to call you Kelly. Sometimes I want to call you Dr. Wright. So, I listed this here, whereas new crimes, new laws, new words, new phrases. So one of the things that language has to keep evolving as crime evolves, as people learn how to do new things, we have to come up with new laws and new names for things. So is there any
face stealing?
Exactly. Face stealing. Exactly. So is there anything specific in linguistics for that area where like you're constantly, you know, for crime, naming crimes or anything like that? Or is it all just come under just the evolution of language?
I mean, there could indeed be folks in forensic linguistics, people who study the law and how it's applied, who have really specific terms for this. But I think about, and I've used this example before, I think about how when Obama made lynching explicitly illegal. So say you walk, but you know, the day before that happened, you went out and tied someone to a tree and had a party about it. You know, you probably are still going to jail. Like it was a murder, right? Like in, you know, the 2010s, but the idea that putting that word into our federal law meant something, that being able to say, this is a crime, this explicit act is a crime, and I don't have, it doesn't need to be under an umbrella of manslaughter or whatever, it needs to be a very specific type of crime with very specific punishments. That has essentially been done or not done for most of the acts that we think are punishable, right? That our government can punish, is that they have either been made more or less specific over time. So you might think of like, we steal, we kill, we X, you know, the stuff that can send you to prison forever, right, has become more or less specified. And it's like, this, these are the things that people fight for, you know, like people are saying like, we need harsher sentences for rapists, or we need, you know, to lessen the, you know, mandatory minimums, right, for crimes. It's like, this kid stole 3 candy bars and now he's in jail for the rest of his life. Like, what's the deal?
Well, yes. And well, okay. And there are so many stories like that, especially when it comes to drugs now. And that's what we're hearing about. One more thing I came across that I thought was interesting, because I was looking, you know, as I was trying, you know, I always find, like, is there a way to thematically, with whatever's going on in reality, tie it into life is like science fiction, linguistics. So I looked up union language, and I'm going to read the definition, but then I'm going to need you to give us the Dr. Wright explanation of this definition. Okay, so union language. Do you know what union language is, Mike from Jersey?
We're not talking about like in the sense of like a union. Union language? What are we talking about?
Yeah.
No, I don't.
What are we talking about? Just say no. The thing. Don't be Byron.
No, I'm okay. Guessing. I, mean, yeah, I don't know.
You
are, I don't.
I know you get.
You're claimed to know.
Byron. Yeah, yeah. I have a co-host, Byron. He asked Byron. He doesn't know. He has an answer though. He's just like, Byron, do you know the answer? No, but he wouldn't even say no. He would just start talking. Anyway, so union language. It says a form of language used in literature and for official and educational purposes that combines vocabulary and grammatical features from a number of related dialects, thus representing a compromise between them. Now, I was trying to figure out, is that like Spanglish, Esperanto, Creole? Like what's a union language? What's an example of a union language?
Great. So yeah, so I'm glad you asked this. Esperanto is a good example of an official language that has done this, that actually like sat down. And so Esperanto is the language of the UN. It was created to like further unify Europe. And they took parts from many different languages and dialects and put it together. And then created resources for people to learn it. So it could be, you know, like a new lingua franca. There are people who speak it and learn it.
A what? Lingua franca? What?
Lingua franca. Lingua franca, it's a...
That sounds like a band, okay?
That would be a bad band. Yeah, I band. Feel like...
Lingua franca. live.
Lingua franca, this is like an old term for like a language, a general language of the people. So historical lingua francas could be Latin or French, right? Where the term comes from, of just an idea that... it's something that everybody used, even though their individual languages were not spoken. So,
root language kind of thing? Or
like a language of an empire, like the state language. You know, so you have like the Holy Roman Empire. Everybody can come together and speak Latin, right? But all of the lands that are being controlled have their own languages. Esperanto was supposed to be one like created for unity, like for the purpose of like unifying like all of these groups, and so therefore attempted to represent different parts of their language structure in it. And it's actually so reported, pretty simple to learn. It's on like Duolingo too or whatever, so people are still, this is like a living language.
People are still speaking Esperanto, is that what you're saying?
Esperanto. Yeah, but I gave the example talking about like Black language in schools, and here in the United States, like that is the linguistic justice efforts that we've been, that I have mentioned, like April Baker Bell and these other folks are doing exactly this. In the last decade or so, there's been an approach in schools to, instead of, you know, sending Black kids, into remedial classes, to instead represent their language in English class. And so you know, in ways that we've had, like you were saying, like more common language versions of the Bible, appear. This is like a more, you know, a writing class where it represents, okay, these students know how to make meaning. They understand their world. They just aren't producing, you know, like formal writing in the way that we like in a dialect. This is a different dialect. Like they recognize that it's actually a switch. Like it's actually like bilingualism. And so this union language is coming to represent like, here are our goals, but we're going to let you do it in your dialect.
Wow, I have to say, just the concept of them coming up with this language sounds like science fiction now. Like, yes, it'll be the wonderful world. We'll all be at peace with each other. We'll communicate.
Yes, the idea that the way that Esperanto didn't give us world peace, yes, right? Yeah, exactly. I mean, it was, that's what a great idea.
Very, like, 50s sci-fi concept.
Well, it's like...
It is. It's like the world of the future, the home of the future.
Well, you literally have it, Blade Runner, where he's sitting there, and you, in the voiceover version, he's like, "I was a mishmash of Japanese, Spanish, and German."
Exactly. That's what it sounds like. Or it's like, "Come to the World's Fair and come to the Esperanto Village. Everybody speaks Esperanto."
It was also like that in, like the Firefly universe,
where they had
incorporated, and that's so what you see in that the Firefly universe is actually kind of what happens in the real world. So. This process that is official in some ways actually happens when any language, two languages or a language and a dialect come into contact. And we call this process like dialect leveling. So the idea is like you have all these codes that come together. You've got sharp points and deep valleys. And that those are the places where they're different, where they're like doing things that are structurally different that just like can't merge.
The little
peaks get sheared off, you know what I mean? Like, and then valleys get filled in, so then everything is flat in the language.
Well, it's interesting, you know, I was at an event, I don't know if you know much about Afrobeat music, but Afrobeat music is a lot like that, where it's a union between hip-hop and African language, and you hear it, and you hear them, they're saying something, like, you don't know what they're saying, and then all of a sudden they're back to, like, yes, and we're on the street, and you're like, oh, okay, so would that be a union?
Yeah, perfect example. I mean, a lot of people call things like fusion in a way that, but when, like linguistically, yeah, like all of these examples like operate the same kind of on the ground and over time, like in an individual's head and then over time.
Gotcha. My friend, you're going to ask something there, Mark from Jersey.
I was, and then I forgot what
you
I
forgot.
Was. I wanted to make the Blade Runner comment.
Basically. Oh, very
well, actually, good. I did have a question. Do you foresee a situation? I guess we're sort of already there, but do you foresee a situation when part of a society or countries or group of society, like Europe, for example, Western Europe, creating artificially, completely a brand new language for its citizens to use, as opposed to an evolution of a previously existing language?
Maybe. I don't, there, that happens. It happens a lot. I say, you know, something to look at is like North Macedonia, right? Which, you know, fought for a very long time to be called North Macedonia. And the language that they are administering on the ground has been deliberately changed. To make it more distinct from Greek and other languages. And then they also are actively teaching their population like this new, what they would call an older version, a more authentic version of their variety that has sort of been bleached of the influence of other dialects around it. So that's maybe like a reverse, that bleaching part is that like what they changed actually made it in their minds more authentic to Macedonian. But the idea of just like an entire country administering a new variety for the purpose of like instilling national pride and ensuring unity and making them recognized on an international stage because their language is distinct. That's something that's maybe needed. And so these were for administrative and ideological purposes.
Administrative and ideological. Wow. Right from Jersey, do you understand? So you are tuned to listener sponsored radio, WBAI 99.5 FM. And we are live and we're here in the studio. I'm Mike Sargent. I'm here with Mike from Jersey, Dr. Kelly Wright. And we're talking about the power of language. We're talking about language protections and the protection of language. Almost afraid to do it. Hello, you're on the air. Yes, hello.
Yes, you're very low. Mr. Sargent.
Yes, this is Mr. Sargent. Who is this?
This is Gregory.
Gregory. All right, you're a regular Gregory.
Yes, right. I am. I love your program. You know, doctor, I have a question as well.
You have a question for the doctor?
Yes, as a matter of fact. You know, I'm struggling with this appellation called black language as if it's something that is innate. Exclusively, quote unquote, black people. What does it actually mean? Is it some linguistic expression of some substandard, sublanguage based purely on what? Experiential, empirical repression, victimhood? What exactly is this? Because I have also a linear question. What is white language? I mean, if white is representative of historical white supremacy, is then white language adverse, repressive?
Yeah, great question. No, thank you. I should have been more specific. So, what black language is, or what I am referring to, is actually a pretty controversial concept, both in my field and in the wider world. So professionally, when I'm writing, I refer to African-American languages. And what that encompasses are the languages of Black people in America, of the Caribbean, of other areas where Africans were imported into the New World. So, and how those have evolved over time. I personally do not use the term Ebonics, although that term has been used to cover the same scope of languages at different times. I do not like to refer to African American language as slang. And as a person of color myself, I do not personally refer to myself as an African American. I refer to myself as a black person. And so because this is a dialect I possess, I refer to it as black language because that's just the way that I identify and what I use. But it is a collection of varieties that have changed over time that are not exclusive to black people. So you do not have to be black to use black language or even have it be your first language, but it is a dialect that has a very specific history and comes from a specific people. And that's why it's labeled with this like racial term. Now, I will also say that in my writing, I refer to standard language or mainstream English as white standardized spoken English. And I do make that racialized distinction because standard language and whiteness, the perception of them go together. So black people can form perfect language and still be told that they are speaking poorly. And it's because of their perception of their race. And I can send some links.
Understood. But the way it's worded is that it sounds as if it's nuanced. Isn't white language a nuance as well? And I challenge the lack of better term, the revisionist history of so-called black people being imported to this region, because historicity, as opposed to history, purports that so-called black people were aboriginal to these lands. And even though revisionist history might challenge that and may purport to find a plausible excuse for the fact, white language, how nuanced is it to where it represents a particular cultural bent that is non-exclusive? Well, yes, exclusive, I should say, and not particularly embracing. Wouldn't you consider that nuanced language, white language?
I am. So one myth that our field works to bust is the idea that any form of language is more or is more complex than another. So we might look at, you know, some of the world's languages and say their morphology is more complex than another, or, you know, the way they make words, or the way, you know, that they, you know, do or don't use pronouns, right? Lots of the world's languages have no pronouns. That's, those kinds of things can be like compared to each other, but in general, every language, every type of language, including signed languages, has the same capacity for description and nuance, like you're saying, than others. Whether or not that nuance is recognized and accepted outside of the community of users is a different question.
One last comment. You mentioned the evolution of language, but isn't there a flip side to the fact of the evolution of language, namely, or more specifically, cultural agnotology, the cultural reduction of cognitive, lack of evisceration of intellect from a culture? Would you consider the flip side of linguistic evolution, where the evolution of language is, I would say, two sides of the same coin?
Okay, so maybe 2 points here. So for me, language is a natural system, and so it evolves like any other system, that being our DNA or our waterways, you know, here on the planet, right? It is part of biology. And so in my opinion, I don't think that biology devolves. I don't think we've seen that, right? Certainly, you know, things have gone extinct, but that is like a natural progression, right, of evolution. We can, though, think about this in maybe another way. So we have language is old. We've talked about this, like an extinct language is one that has completely passed from human memory, right? There are no texts. There are no scrolls. There are no stone tablets. There is not a living memory. It is passed from human memory. That in some ways can be thought of as de-evolution because it is extinct. There's no life. It's not ongoing. That particular code is no longer in use. I don't know that I can comment on the effect on the intellect.
You know, one last thing. I don't want to hold.
Yeah, because we do want to take a few more calls. I want to give out the number.
There is a tiny agency called the United States Board on Geographic Names. One of its purports to want to anglicize the entire world's language and culture. Isn't that, in practice, the evolution of language? And again, it's called the United States Board on Geographic Names.
Anglicize the world. Language.
Yeah,
that sounds like a James Bond plot.
That's like a great way for me to just start screaming for
2 hours. Actually, Doctor, I had a question at something you said earlier. You were talking, you mentioned the term ebonics, and that you do not use that term. Would you say that that is a negative term, and if so, why?
So, I think, in my opinion, from when I was growing up, it was very maligned. Absolutely. I don't, it's a blend. I don't know. It's ebony phonics is Ebonics, ebony plus phonics. That right there, I'm mad. I'm already mad. I don't, that's not what my language is. It's not ebony phonics. Right. Okay. So that said, there are people who use that variety, and that is what they describe it as. That's what they describe it as today. So it could be called that. It could be called African American vernacular English. It could be called slang. It could be just in general slang, right? So there are a lot of Black, and this is part of my research, is like I bring Black professionals into the lab and they talk to me about their linguistic experiences. So I personally don't use Ebonics in the same way that I personally like don't use African American, right? Like it's just what I choose to identify myself and my language use with. But I do spend a lot of time in the, you know, rooms that I'm in making sure that, you know, like the word slang is actually referring to informal, you know, casual and informal language use, right? Instead of and a whole variety or all of these things that like, this is language and all of this other stuff is broken or crap or whatever. That's like part of the reason why I move away from that term, just because of the use I've seen it do.
Okay. I think she answered your question quite well, actually.
And, all right. And I say that obviously as a white dude.
Yes, as a white dude. All right.
You're so white.
He's no. White.
Yes, I am.
Exactly. White? And asking me that question, then you're white. All right. So I want to give out the phone number. It's 212-209-2877. If the phones are actually working. I mean, Gregory got through, so you could try. 212.
Thanks, Gregory.
Yes, Gregory. He's gone now, but
thank you, Gregory.
He did. He had a lot of interesting questions, and because now we're pulling you into this now, Kelly, because now you're becoming like a regular. So now we won't only talk about linguistic things. Now we can talk about our bread and butter. Okay, and what's interesting is one of the bread and butter stories that. You know, I say bread and butter for Night and Shift is life is like science fiction. And you wanted to talk about the AI-powered brain implants.
Oh, wow.
That could spy on our innermost thoughts.
Oh, yeah.
Did you know about this?
I didn't know about it.
Yeah, of course it would. So, what now? You wanted to talk about it, like, because you know I want to talk about it, but I'm totally curious what you want.
I want to know. I want to hear from you, like, why you chose this and, like, how this article came to you. I'm interested before I shred it.
All right. Well, first of all, a couple of things. This is the kind of stuff we cover a lot here on the show. And brain implants, getting chipped is something that at least 20 years ago?
Oh, yeah.
Jersey?
Oh, from the very beginning, you were talking about getting chipped.
Yeah,
people getting chipped.
Now, keep in mind, Kelly, Mike from Jersey has been listening to the show since he was a teenager. Okay.
Right.
He listened to the show as a teenager. Now he's a full grown adult and still listens. Actually, comes
on.
He's
a grown bleep man.
He's a grown.
A fresh 25.
Yeah, a fresh 25, bro. But so many, many years ago, he was listening to the show. And back then, I read a lot of science fiction. My prediction is that we will eventually all become chipped. And then I think it'll, you know, I think it'll be the easy way. It'll start as something medical, and then it'll be something for travel, and then it'll be something for your kids and for sex offenders and for old people. And there'll be a million reasons to get chipped. And eventually everybody will get chipped. Now, once we're used to chipping, you know, brain implants, chipping, so to me, this is just where we're going as a species. So whenever I see stories like this, I knew it. So that's kind of my rationale for wanting to cover a story like this. So now I can read the story to folks, but I want to hear you. Why is this something you wanted to talk about?
Because I actually knew something about. And I like read the study that they did, the study that they're quoting.
All right. Well, wait, let's give.
Well, we'll talk about it. But I actually work with some of these tools so I can, you know, adjust your fear level.
Okay. All right. Well,
like AI tools we're talking about?
The tools they use to do the MRI.
All right, here it is. Okay, it says the UN warns that AI-powered brain implants could spy on our innermost thoughts. And the quote they use here, this is kind of clickbaity, it says here, "We are on a path to a world in which algorithms will enable us to decode people's mental processes." First of all, algorithms are already decoding people's mental processes. Right. But that's just me. All right, it says here, so it goes under the heading of, and I love these headings. These are the headings for the sections of the article. Thought police, brain-o-scope, massive investment. You know, these are all the headings for the article. So it says here, the United Nations Educational, Scientific, and Cultural Organization, that's UNESCO, has sounded the alarm bell on neurotechnology, warning that its warp speed advancement, catalyzed by artificial intelligence, poses a threat to human rights and mental privacy.
By the way, can I just say quickly, I never thought in my wildest dreams that UNESCO would be like having some protest against artificial intelligence.
What world am I living in right now? Life is like science fiction. Come on. The fact that this is just an article I'm reading, this is not like the first chapter of an Arnold Schwarzenegger movie from the 90s. All right, it says, in response, UNESCO will develop an ethical framework to address potential human rights concerns raised by neurotech. It said at an international conference in Paris on Thursday. It says, we're on a path to a world in which algorithms will enable us to decode people's mental processes and directly manipulate the brain mechanisms underlying their intentions, emotions, and decisions. This sounds like They Live or, you know, what was that Frank Sinatra movie? All right. It says, Gabriela Ramos, UNESCO Assistant Director General Social and Human Sciences, said at the event. Now, this is the next heading of Brainoscope. Roughly speaking, neurotech describes electronic devices that can connect with your brain or nervous system, such as brain-computer interfaces. Okay, that's a thing. All right. Also known as brain implants and brain scans. Typically, the tech has been reserved more for medical purposes, like helping paralyzed people move again or regain their eyesight. We're coming back to intent here, Kelly. Regain their eyesight or hearing. But recent advances have given experts pause over its potential invasiveness. One study, and this is the study you worked on, this is the study you know about, okay. One study, now I didn't highlight the study, but I could. It says, one study with decidedly dystopian implications was able to successfully pair the use of a large language model, AI, with a functional MRI brain scan to literally read people's thoughts and spell them out in words. It's like putting neurotech on steroids, sits an unpronounceable UNESCO economist specializing in AI. I say unpronounceable because her name is like Maria Grazia Scucciniari.
So hold on a second. Beyond like reading your thoughts, couldn't you, let's say, have a military application where you have a squad of soldiers and all of their chips are connected? They're basically feeding each other formations.
How did they spend $42 million on Viagra for the Army? How did that happen? All right, so, you didn't hear that?
I didn't know this.
Did you see this, Kelly? She's just shaking her. All women know this. Like, women know. I talk to men, they're like, what? No, the military didn't do that.
What did they need Viagra for?
to fight better. So, what do you know about this study?
Yeah, this is so interesting. To me. Okay, so I guess where to start? Not to say let's not worry about the eugenics of all of this, you know, the slippery slope designer babies.
What could go wrong?
I mean, nothing if you're an Ubermensch. Okay, so this idea of like to decode people's mental processes, right? That's like what this AI could do, or what this neurotech could do, would be helping to decode people's mental processes. So two things. That is what I do as a researcher. is attempt to decode people's mental processes. So as someone who studies perception, right, like I give you something to perceive and then I spend like weeks, months, years on the back end trying to figure out what you perceived, what it was that you were actually responding to. I'm trying to decode your mental process. But more than that, this is exactly what we're doing when we're using language as well. Right. So between the two of us, the three of us, the everyone who's listening of us, you know, we're working, and this gets right at this intent versus impact question is like, when we use language, we're working to encode our mental process in the physical world. Language is the externalization of thought. Right. And so like my thoughts don't always translate one to one. We're not telepathic. I can't put my thought directly into your head. I have to slap bits of meat around in my face, use my hands, you know, to create a transfer of information, right? To get my mental process out into the world and then hopefully into you with the least amount of, you know, interference, right? That is what all human communication is attempting to do. Right. And when I'm listening to you, I'm attempting to decode your mental process, figure out how you got to that utterance and why. So like the actual operation there is maybe less scary because, I mean, unless I'm terrifying as a researcher, you know, it's maybe less scary. Also, right, this idea of like it would be used to manipulate our thoughts and intentions and emotions and decisions and like all this. Again, very scary. Like I don't want anyone putting thoughts in my head, but that is again exactly what we use language for. So if I want to convince someone that I'm being sincere or that I love them or that I hate them or I need them to do something for me, I need to manipulate them to make a specific decision. That is what we use language for. That is, these are like the highest reasons why we externalize thought is to communicate our emotions, share our intentions, get people to do stuff for us. Right. So what, I mean, essentially what they're saying is like this neurotech on steroids, the steroids part is just amping up what our brain and body is already doing. Right. So I think like the underlying process itself is maybe not very scary. They make it sound so much worse than it is. If you want to talk about the science in that MRI study, we can.
Okay. Well, we can talk about the science, but I'll tell you.
Sounds pretty damn scary.
I think it sounds pretty damn scary too. And I'll tell you why. I'll tell you why. It doesn't sound, the science does not sound scary. The technology does not sound scary. What sounds scary, like for instance, you know, you say you talk about communication and it's all about trying to communicate and decode. Well, technology, it affects how we communicate. If we find new ways of communicating, new ways of reading thoughts, new ways of communicating, we change how we communicate or we tap into, you know, for instance, you know, whether it's, you know, it used to be you got crank calls on your home phone. Then you got crank calls on your cell phone. Then you got spam calls. Then you got people who are trying to steal your identity from your phone. So people find ways to use technology to do nefarious things. So to me, the fact that the technology exists and it has the potential to do all these great things is fine. But also the reason UNESCO and the reason we have all of the language of protection and all these laws is we have to, because human beings are capable of some not good things. And sure. I also feel that that's kind of, you know, coming back to the SAG thing, I feel, you know, when, I don't know if you heard, you know, there are a couple of things that stood out to me. One was the unknown executive who said, like, we'll just wait them out until they're...
I read that the night that it broke.
Yes. Yeah. We'll wait them out until they lose their homes. Okay. And then, I don't know if you're also aware of this offer they made for, you know, basically telling, you know, background actors they only have one...
Yes,
I get it. One-day career. You know, we just take your image forever and... You know,
the thing that blew my mind, I was actually watching, I think it was like Friday or whatever, I just happened to have CNBC, and I usually don't watch CNBC, and Bob Iger was on, and he made the comment that he finds the fact that these people that are striking want more rights are quote-unquote disturbing.
Well, again, I was actually going to play the quote, but the point I'm making is the Bob Iger, all of it says to me, the fact that they could offer that tells you just how little they think of artist, how little they think of the actor, how little they think of the writer, how to them they're insignificant. So to me,
wouldn't you say, Mike, as a filmmaker yourself, wouldn't you say that part of the issue, if you maybe oversimplify it, and look at the people that are running the studio now versus before, the people at the top are maybe less inclined
I don't think any of that's changed. I think it's just new ways. This is where I'm getting at. It's just streaming is just a new way of screwing over the actors. It's just a new way. They screwed over the actors when syndication came. They screwed over the actors when TV came and movies were running on TV. So I'm just saying it's a new way. And what I'm saying to you, Kelly, is what's scary about that is not that the technology exists, but now it's just a new way for bad things to happen. That's my concern because I don't have a lot of faith in humans.
Sure. And I don't think that's unwarranted. Two things. This reminds me of the debate over cloning, which UNESCO was also at the heart of, and people were rightly concerned about where that technology was headed, but we haven't all been replaced by doppelgangers. I mean, it to our knowledge. And so I think that's like,
was that the fear that we'd be replaced by doppelgangers?
You're not afraid of it?
No, I'm not afraid. I'm not afraid. Come at me, twin. Okay. Good. No,
it's
that
I think of. Oh, sorry. Go ahead.
Would you clone yourself, Mike?
No, I have to say that movie. They cloned Tyrone.
Oh, yeah.
It's fantastic.
Oh, really?
It's one of the best movies I've seen this year. Highly, 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 highly recommend it. It's really good. But no, finish what you're saying, Doctor.
I just think that I was, really happy to read something that made sense to me in this context. Because very often, it's like, you don't know when things are being amped up. And so the short version is, they're very far away from what they're saying we should be afraid of, right? That the neuroimplantation, like, tech is, I worked, was, like, trained in a lab where people were doing studies on people who had strokes. And so the idea is like something very localized is implanted to stop that stroke, right? And so that, we're very far away from it. The AI is completely outside of the brain in this study. You know, they're giving them really specific tasks and saying, we noticed something, happened in a specific area of the brain, which is, not surprising. Cause like, if you say the word jump, like if you say a verb versus jump versus confess, like those things happen in different areas of the brain because most people say jump and pretty much everyone does it in the same way. It's connected to your motor system versus like confess is something that's like going to be in a lot of different places for a lot of different individuals. It's less localized. So it's like that kind of thing of, they did something that was maybe not. It was like the very next step and not the last step.
All right, listen. 10 years from now, you're going to come back on the show, okay? When everybody's got an implant, okay? And they are jumping into people's brains and they're hacking people's brains and making people do stuff and people buying stuff and they don't want to. And I'm going to say, I told you. That's right.
I think of like, we're worried about how people are directly manipulating others. Like, it's happening. Look at Barbie Mania.
Right.
Well, I did see the film tonight. I will say that. And it's...
Nuh-uh. Why do you get to do everything? Why do you get to do everything?
Mike, are you allowed to talk about it? Or?
I think the embargo's off. People have been talking about it. People have been talking about the film. So I can talk about it. I can give my review. I can give a non-spoiler review. Well, first of all, I'll say this. I mean... it's clever. It's fun. I am not a big Greta Gerwig fan. I'm not a big Margot fan either. So, and I'm not a big Ryan fan I'm not a big fan of any of them, but I don't dislike any of them. Okay, so I didn't go into it with any big expectations, but I didn't go into it with any, you know, expecting to be wowed or expecting to hate it. So I thought it was fun. It's occasionally inspired. It's a bit uneven. It never quite achieves the level I think that it's going for. Wow. But it's amusing. So that's my review.
How intelligent is it?
It's pretty smart. It's a pretty smart film. It's pretty smart. It's, you know, I mean, Greta Gerwig and Noah Baumbach wrote it together. And I actually think that that's part of the flaw of the film, honestly, because I think for what it's trying to do, I don't really think it needed a man to write. I feel like I would have wanted to see a more complete vision, like
because of what the sort of psychological meaning of Barbie is to a female.
Well, they hit that pretty hard, okay. and I enjoyed it. And there's some, you know, there's some crowd pleasing speeches and things like that, and it's got a, like everybody and their mother shows up in the movie. Right. You know, again, it's good, it's fun.
How's the guy from Shang-Chi?
He's fun. Okay. He's fun. See me. So he's fun. Are you excited? Are you like, you can't wait to see it?
Yeah, I mean, I really, yeah, tomorrow's my birthday and I really wanted to see it, but it's not going to be here until Friday.
Right. Happy birthday.
I mean, I'm definitely a lifelong Barbie. I still collect them.
You still collect them? Do you have any, like, are you going to show us any right here?
Mike, are you going to have a present?
I'm going to get one.
Yes. Are you going to have a present ready for her when it turns midnight?
Yes. It's a no prize. What did we used to give out? A bag of glory.
Bag of glory, yes.
Bag of glory. So, all right. Well, you are tuned to Listen to Sponsored Radio, WBAI, and we'll actually take a couple calls here. People were calling. The phone number is 212-209-2877. That's what is the phone number here? Mike from Jersey? See that?
Oh, okay. Got it. Okay. 212-209-2877.
Where is it?
It's right here.
Oh, wow. Look at that. A Katherine Johnson. She's got a Katherine Johnson Barbie. I didn't know they made Katherine Johnson Barbie.
Isn't she perfect?
So, Mike from Jersey?
Yes, sir.
Are you excited to see... Oppenheimer? Are you?
Oppenheimer, yes. I love how he, like, genderly specifically asked me.
Well, of course, because everybody wants to see either one or the other or both. People seem to be... It's interesting to me that everybody wants to see this cautionary tale. You know, and I guess it's really Christopher Nolan. He's really created a brand for himself.
I think it's going to be good. I want to see it. I just... It's interesting to me that people are saying Barbenheimer and not Oppenarby.
What do you think the likelihood is that the two films are going to be split down the middle in terms of gender audience turnout?
Well, I think it's obvious, but I think people are curious. I think people are curious on both levels.
I don't know. I think more men are going to get dragged to the Barbie movie than choose to go to Oppenheimer.
Actually, yeah, that's a point.
No, I think it's going to be. I think it'll be an interesting mix. We can discuss it on the next show.
I want to see it, but I got to say, I'm predicting that it's going to be the Cillian Murphy career performance.
Are you really? Well, that's what everybody's already saying. So. All right, again, you are tuned to Listen to Sponsored Radio, WBAI, and this is still Night Shift.
But I'm not.
I want it.
My nose is 0.2 millimeters too narrow, and my cheekbones are 0.4 millimeters too high.
I want it too.
after television commercials. They want a certain look.
I did surgery on several girls a few months back, commercial actresses. And there have been some suicides.
You don't know what's going on. This is more than commercials. They're killing all the girls that are perfect.
DMI measured some girls for possible surgery. We were conducting an experiment.
Hi, I'm Cindy. I'm the perfect female type, 18 to 25.
Here you see a typical computer model being made.
Hi, I'm Cindy. I'm the perfect female type, 18 to 25.
What have you got me mixed up in? I have a right to know if somebody's trying to kill me.
Now, that was the trailer for Looker, and the premise was that they were taking these girls, and they were, and I say girls because they were these young women from 18 to 25, and they were digitally taking their images and putting them into the computer, and then they kill the girl and then just use the image and then be making lots of money on these models. And that was the diabolical scheme. And that was Michael Crichton back in 1981. Predicting what Hollywood made as an offer now to
actors. I think Crichton is going to go down in history as like the next H.G. Wells.
Well, I think we, you know, as some actor said it, that we're in an inflection point. Maybe it was George Clooney, but I think it's true. I think we are at a place where the industry is going to, it has to change in many ways, and I think it's going to help independent film quite a bit. I think it's also going to is what's happening. It's the delivery system. So I think streaming changed everything, and the pandemic accelerated streaming. So it's sort of like they were getting away with murder, but now they can really get away with murder because they weren't paying for streaming anyway, but streaming was only a small part of the market. When it took over the market, and now it's, you know, almost bigger than theatrical in many ways, and Netflix was very smart in that they never reveal, like, you know, box office or like
the fact that Netflix already has all these like Korean shows that don't have anything to do with
American. Well, that's and did you hear the Squid Game? Did you hear how the creator of Squid Game never got a dime all of that?
Yes.
Okay, so there it is. This is the
Korean
business.
It's not union. It doesn't count.
There it is, as Charlton Heston says. That was the kind of world we'd made. So, anything you want to say about that, Kelly?
No, I mean, I agree. I think, you know, Crichton was really prescient. This is also an episode of 30 Rock where they do Seinfeld vision, and they're just like, we have so much footage of Jerry Seinfeld saying basically anything, we can just plop him into whatever show.
There it
is. And they do that without his consent. And then Jerry Seinfeld shows up for like 2 minutes on one episode of 30 Rock.
That's funny. Well, but you see, that is the future, I think, also of digital. I mean, you know, there was a rumor for a while that Bruce Willis had done it, then he didn't really do it. But you could
well,
believe
I've seen the Russian commercials that he's in. It's, or rather, I should say, his likeness is in. It's crazy.
Well, you know, here's I have a question for you though. My question for you, Dr. Wright, is. You were saying that this is what you do. You know, you give these tests to humans and you ask them questions or things, and then you try and analyze their response. And you could take years to look at all that data. And what if, or do you have any fear that one day they may just have AIs look at all that data, and a lot of the work that you do, all this studying of human behavior, could be done by AI? And eliminate the need, quote unquote, for humans.
Well, in a way, that already happens. So I use large language models in my work as well. You know, when I study the media, you know, in other aspects, it would take longer than a human life for me to be able to actually encode all that data. And so I use AI to help me, but it also has like a really specific and defined task. It's not generalized AI, right? Which is what everyone has been talking about and is super afraid of. I think, in the types of studies that I do where I'm not using that, right? The ones that take all of this time for me to encode all of the data and set it up. That would essentially be like a first step. Like, so for me, I've done a study, I figured out what the patterns are, and now I could train a machine to look for those specific things that I'm interested in the next time I go and get data. So then, and that's part of the reason why we take such time, you know, in analyzing and trying to figure out like what patterns are actually emerging, right? Do I worry that a human could look at the data like I do in that initial stage? I do, because I think that language models are being applied to earlier and earlier stages of research for lots of folks. So removing the human who is the one who's using language from that analysis just makes, it's like we were talking about when we had an episode about AI and models. What the data that they get fed in the beginning when they're first trained, it really leaves like an imprint on how they work in the future. So if people are using these imperfect models at earlier stages of their work, then their work, you know, also picks up the imprint of that imperfection as well. So that's what concerns me more than removing the person. Like in theory, again, like in theory, these would be useful. It's just a question of how they're used or who uses.
All right, I have more scary questions for you. But Mike from Jersey, do you have a question? Because I felt like you were going to ask something there. Okay, wait, go ahead. What were we going to ask?
I was going to ask something, but I'm going to have to try and remember.
Okay, Mike from Jersey. It's his late night, Mike from Jersey. Well, you know, you said something else that made me think as well in terms of the future. You worry about, you know, potentially, you know, there are definitely aspects of your job that could be done and already are being done better with computer. I'm wondering if, you know, there's always this fear, you know, and again, I think it's a legitimate fear that, you know, the AIs, since essentially a computer can outthink us and can, and like you said, a human lifetime to do the work that a computer could do, you know, in a matter of hours or days or whatever. I'm wondering about language. What are your thoughts about, you know, there have been various times where AIs or these computer learning models have started to create their own language, where the creators had to shut it down because they didn't know what was happening. And I'm just wondering, considering, like you said, a lot of this is this programming and what these things are built are based on human thought. Do you, not even getting into sentience, but can you see these computers creating their own language? And do you feel that as a natural progression in terms of this kind of an intelligence?
Yes. I think that a natural progression is maybe.
It's a weird thing to say about computers, right?
It is and it isn't. I mean, it's like you think about binary, you know, ones and zeros, how we, you know, very first taught computers how to talk or think or compute. If that was trinary code, right? You know, it's just the exponential of it all, right? Like it adds like this additional layer of incredible complexity. It makes sense that a machine that is programmed to learn from how we use language would recognize the complexity and flexibility of using something that's more, you know, that has more options than binary. So I think that kind of like natural, quote unquote, natural observation, like from the program that's told to learn from what we give it and we give it human language data. It makes sense that it would develop code for its own, at least for like shorthand processes and such. I think that my like biggest concern right now is information sharing between these companies. So like the combination of length of models. But as I was talking, you know, like a lot of these models still have really narrowly defined tasks. Like the same with like ChatGPT, it's just going to spit language back at you. It's not hooked into anything, but as they start hooking it into things and it learns from more things and more two different models come into contact.
Yes.
Right.
Colossus this is, and Guardian.
That is what I, you know, in the future, you know, worry about is when right now there isn't an AI on this planet that approaches the human neuron. It's not anywhere close faster, but not more complex or et cetera, right?
But that can change. I mean, you know.
That can change and will change.
Right. If we're talking about just sheer mathematics, it's just a larger number.
Now, did you see this story? An MIT student, they have video of this MIT student surfing the internet using his mind, silently Googling questions and receiving answers through skull vibrations. Did you see this? I sent you the link. You saw this. So what are your thoughts on that?
Like a chip?
Like do you see us, this is the final question, do you see us evolving past actual language at some point as humans? You know, I know you watch Star Trek.
Yeah, no, so it's a device. You wear it along the jaw.
Yes, it is. Yes, it is.
And so a lot, maybe. Do I see us evolving past the need to use language? Maybe.
Language regularly, let's put it like that. Because that means everybody gets by.
Are you thinking just about speech or writing too? You know what I mean?
Well, I think we've stopped writing a lot already.
But are we, that's the thing is like, are we going to get to the point where we don't have to flap our faces around or hands around to communicate? Maybe. Are we going to get to the point where we don't have to encode the present, you know, preserve our history as a species? That I don't know. I think that's our greatest evolutionary advantage. You know, when people talk about language is what separates us from the animals, it is not our language. It is our history. We're the only species that encodes history. And because of that, we have dominion over the planet. Right. If we end up finding a way to communicate telepathically, which again, it's not going to take much. I don't know if we'd stop writing. I don't know if we'd stop encoding our own individual perspectives and experiences just because I can communicate with a person right in front of me much easier.
What are your thoughts on directly. That, Mike from Jersey?
Let me ask you a question. So in terms of, wait, what are you showing me here?
I'm showing you the MIT student with the skull thing around his skull, reading Google's mind.
Right. Okay, so in terms of the way that the, God, how do I put it? What if you had a society, like a hypothetical society in the future that there are a group or even maybe a new religion where the rules are very simple. We only communicate by thought. How likely do you think something like that could be and what would
kind of... That's the same question I just asked her. Okay. What are you asking the same question
okay.
for?
Is it the same question with a hypothetical?
With the hypothetical, Leah. What would the name of the city be?
Yeah, no, I think that's maybe possible. You know, I don't know what it takes, you know, but if we look at like our evolution, we have been growing into, you know, we have like this forward, you know, we're upright, forward facing, bipedal, you know, individuals with like a full sensory array on the front side of our bodies, but right? Nerve endings here.
You think that spoken language will, even with that ability, that spoken language will continue to exist?
She said written language more.
I don't know. This is me saying, I think that, you know, if we, This telepathy idea of like us not having to communicate with words, maybe eventually we would not have to write anything down at all. Language would like disappear in a material sense because like human, like babies are born with like memory, like access to all human history or something. Or it's something that could be transferred like during child rearing.
Because well, you get the brain implant when you're little and it teaches you everything you need to know.
Yeah, because right now, like you think about our genome, there's a lot of things we don't have to relearn. We don't have to learn how to be upright, forward facing, bipedal, you know, like there's a lot that we don't have to relearn. And that's part of what our evolution is looking out for, is the next shortcut it can take to encode something in our DNA so we don't have to teach, we don't have to teach babies how to do it.
So like we could be born with cell phones in our imprinted in our hands.
Well, okay. So we're born. Babies today are born anticipating a digital environment.
Yes, they are.
And we were not.
No. Well, you know, as a matter of fact, it's one of the...
What if you had like an implant, like let's say babies know how to swim, but you forget that unless you keep them going. And in fact, there's footage of babies swimming. So you could put a chip that would basically let people retain the ability to swim into adulthood.
Well, I'll go further than that. There have been studies that when they test what it is to take a genius, you know, essentially all children are geniuses up until like 5 or 6. And then as the older they get, the less... They are on how they measure genius on that scale. So,
and this is like, part of Chomsky's idea of universal grammar is that we're born essentially with, you know, a control board, and there's a number of switches. So like every individual has access to all the possible codes of human language that exist. It's just if you're born in Finland, you know, as you're growing it, as an infant, all of the switches get turned off except for Finnish. That's the idea of universal grammar, right? And so, you know, maybe we would be moving towards a space where nobody's switches get turned off, right? Like you retain access to just languaging in general.
There it is. A world where nobody's switches gets turned off.
So basically Ghost in the Shell.
Actually, exactly, yes.
All right, well, we're coming into the final 25 minutes of the show here, and, you know, we've been talking a little bit about life is like science fiction, and I'm bringing back some of the sections we have on the show. One of them is, you know, the word of the week, and the word of the week, I chose this word only because of what's been happening at my apartment. It happened first when the pandemic started.
What's going on in your apartment?
I'm going to tell you. Like these pigeons laid two eggs and they laid 2 eggs on the air conditioner. But then the eggs, you know, didn't hatch, didn't work out, okay. Went away, all right, yeah. So it was sad. Then in the last few months, pigeon came, laid 2 eggs, 2 babies born, got good to her, laid another one, brought that one up. That was good. Laid another one. There's another one growing right out my window now. Pigeons. I've had like all these. They're out there all morning making these noises when they feed. And it's just, I'm telling you.
So you're literally watching like the miracle of birth on a regular basis.
I can tell you exactly what baby pigeons look like and when they start to grow. I have video. Now, the word of the week is... peristeuronic. Have you ever heard of this word?
I gotta be honest and say no, and if I did, it probably would be in a spelling bee.
Yeah, alright, I'll spell it for you. P-E-R-I-S-T-E-R-O-N-I-C. Peristeuronic. Have you heard this word before?
No, not until today.
Okay. Definition: of or relating to pigeons.
Automatically, we're talking about pigeons.
That's what the word means. Wow. There it is. It says, when we speak of someone with fine eyesight, as eagle-eyed, hawk, lens, itself to a variety of words, but rarely do we compare anyone to the humble, intelligent pigeon. Truth be told, it is unlikely that you have a distinct need to use this word anytime soon, but that's the word of or relating to pigeons. So, I just told you peristeuronic story about the pigeons.
So hold on a second. So the definition is implying that like, say, for example, in slang, that being called a pigeon is a negative thing. You're like a chump or a stool pigeon.
Well, you know, that's the only time you ever might have called somebody a pigeon is a stool pigeon. And I don't even really know what that is other than pigeons.
Somebody who squeals.
Yes. So,
yeah, or coos, I guess. I don't know. It's like the nat, and this is interesting. Like they're giving an example of it in use.
Yes.
But the use is an exhibition of the National Peristeronic Society. And so that's actually funny because you have a word like, well, this one is like perista, Greek, the Greek word for dove, plus onic, which comes from like demonic. You know, so it's all like, it's like a dove demon or a demon dove, which demon. Is funny. But then like, yeah, this national society, you assume, is trying to like protect or value the pigeon. But and like kudos. But the you know, you think about a word like philatelic, right? Which is like a stamp.
I want to know. First of all, I want to know the history behind the formation of that organization.
Exactly.
Yeah, same. And is it still running?
Exactly. Like, what do they do with the meetings? You know,
like, is it like furries? Hey, are they like furries?
Exactly.
They or maybe I'm like talking smack about the pigeon. What are we gonna
exactly,
do?
Exactly. Damn it. So yeah,
that was great stool pigeon.
Yeah, that was he does good stool pigeon. So. You want to give out the phone number again?
Yes, sir.
See if any of these calls can come through.
212-209-2877.
Now, speaking of birds, okay, I'm going to give you one more phrase here from the common labor terms.
Oh, yeah.
You ready? Double-breasted operation.
I never heard of it.
Okay.
Sounds great, though.
Exactly. A condition where an employer operates two closely related companies, one with a union contract and one without. Under such operation, the employer will normally assign most of the work to the non-union segment of his two companies. Double-breasted operation.
That's like, actually, like, wow. That's a genius.
Wow.
It really does encompass all that.
It's all these, they had to come up with all these phrases because people find every kind of, you know, way of getting slick and getting away with something. So I found that, I thought that was an interesting, there's a couple more in here that are interesting. But what, do you find that interesting there?
No, I like that. It works. Yeah, it's like, it's pretty perfect.
Yeah, it is. It's a double-breasted up. Hey. You're running a double-breasted operation here.
So you realize that some writer between now and the end of the writer's strike is going to use that term in a
story. You know,
it's going to take off.
It's funny because now that I think about it, I used to do printing back in the day, and I do remember there was, you know, certain kind of work had to be done union.
Right.
So he had the small union shop to do the union work. Like when you had to do any political work, it always has to be done by the union because, you know, politicians can't do any printing if it's not done in a union shop. So,
right.
But he would do a lot of the work at the non-union side and charge the union rate. So there it is. That's, you know, God bless America. So did you give out the phone number?
212-209-2877.
Double-breasted operation.
That's actually
fantastic.
It is. Come on down.
Thinking of the logo right now.
Exactly. It's headed like a bird. So let me ask you a question, Mike from Jersey.
Yes.
For you, because you are a writer yourself, and did you have any thoughts, anything you want to say about the WGA, the strike, or anything? Because I know you had some things you wanted to say here towards the end, Kelly.
Yeah,
or did you already get to say them?
So, well, me? Who are we talking to?
The doctor.
The good doctor?
The doctor, yes. So go ahead, I'm listening. Michael.
I think it's horrifying on so many levels. I really feel for all those guys, some of which I know.
There's some girls too, you know.
And females, excuse me.
Guys.
Guys in general.
Gals. There's some gals.
Guys and gals. It's terrible, and I hope something happens. And you know, I want to have my stories by next year, so get it together. I don't know. I mean, here's my question, Mike. Do you think how likely?
When you say your stories, you mean like what Grandma says? I'm watching my stories.
Yeah, exactly.
Is that what you mean?
Like, okay. I want to see my Marvel
stories on back. Go ahead.
What happens to Nick Fury in season two? Do you think that, for example, that it's possible that, let's say, you know, wealthy members of the Screenwriters Guild or Actors Guild are maybe going to carry the large majority of the workforce that's obviously working class?
No, I think
they should like maybe put together a fund and keep those, because the studio is trying to literally starve people to the point of losing their house or apartment.
But that's a bargaining tactic, and again, here's the way I see it. It's sort of writers and actors didn't realize they were on the plantation, okay? And it's sort of like when they freed the slaves. It's like, all right, you're free. Where are you going to go? We can't allow you to work anywhere. So where are you going to go? You got to come right back here. So it's the same kind of thing. So it's a plantation mentality, in my opinion. Do you agree with me, Doctor?
That's kind of wild.
Right?
Yeah, no, I see it. I mean, I definitely do. I think, at least in my experience, like, the graduate students at the University of Michigan have been striking for months. Mm-hmm. And it very much is that of like, mm-hmm. well, your career is over if you don't mm-hmm. stay here. So we you know, it's the vice grip.
I mean, it's definitely true that certain Hollywood producers or television producers see their employees as slaves.
Well, it's an industry. I mean, you know, I don't want to sound like a broken record, but I mean, this country literally was built on a philosophy of exploiting the work of humans, other humans. You know, this is an exploit economy, an exploit country. That's what, you know, everything about it. So it's kind of hard to not see that that wouldn't be happening there to me. So that's anything you want to say there, Dr. Wright, do you?
It's just, you know, it makes me think of, like, I think it's Chris Rock, you know, the like, a minimum wage just means, like, if I could pay you less.
That's right, I would. Exactly. That's what I always say. Like, most business, the business model is flawed. You know, if a successful business, you can't be successful if you paid insurance.
But here's the real question. Like, are we now at the point where corporate society has literally turned into a Philip K. Dick novel where they're just too powerful to, you know, CEOs are just too powerful now to just not get their way?
Well, I don't know if it's too powerful to not get their way, but I think it's too disconnected to see that they should give way. That's what I'd say. I'd say when you see, you know, Iger and you see Zaslav and you see these people, you know, you probably saw a couple months ago when Zaslav spoke at this college and he just got booed.
He got booed through the whole thing, yes.
The whole thing, but he was like oblivious. It's like, yeah, so whatever.
Yeah, he just ignored it. He just kept going.
$489 million last year. So what?
I'm laughing last.
He made $489 million last year.
Right.
That's his salary.
And he cut a lot of fat off of HBO.
Of course.
Warner Brothers.
So, and he produced nothing. He starred in nothing. He wrote nothing. So what does he care? He didn't have to act. He didn't have to write. He's smart. He's find ways to screw you.
So here's my very kind of maybe naive question.
Smart only in America.
Is art in Hollywood dying?
Well, was it ever really alive?
Well, some would argue art house movies like Scorsese.
Well, all right. I would argue that
that's just mainstream.
Yeah, but I would say that. You know, if you look at the beginning of film, you know, it was created for one reason, right? And it became something, and then, you know, this money was made. And I won't even touch upon, you know, the whole, you know, what happened with black filmmakers and all the
yes.
early part of the 19th, the 20th century. But coming into the, by the time it became a business, it was run, look how it was run. It was a studio system. It was like, you know, you just were a player. You just acted. It was a studio system for years, for decades, until, you know, Charlie Chaplin and some other, they created United Artists. And then, you know, by the time the 60s came and film had spread to all these other countries and other filmmakers were being considered, and America wasn't the only one making great film, you know, the industry changed because of art, okay? But, it, you know, and that's what gave birth to everything we saw, the 60s, the 70s, and, you know, the 80s arguably is not necessarily the most artistic time in the movies. But I'm just saying, that's why we feel like it's always been about the art, but I don't think it's always been about the art.
Do you think
that's my opinion.
Do you think that the birth of the blockbuster, essentially like for Jaws and onward, has changed that and has reverted?
No, I mean, I think you can still do big budget art. I think you can do big budget. I mean, Nolan does big budget art films, in my opinion.
Is Barbie an art movie?
Barbie's more like an art director.
Okay. Movie.
So what are your thoughts there, Dr. Wright? Do you have any thoughts? Do you agree, disagree?
Well, I think that we can certainly say that the medium itself is being used for artistic purposes outside of mainstream Hollywood.
Yes.
I don't think there's any reason to say that film is particularly different than, you know, other like the stage or like other forms of art and entertainment that have gone mainstream, but also have always, you know, always been practiced by individuals. And so I can't, you know, it's difficult for me to separate that of like the corporate version of the creation of it all. There's something else I was going to say left.
Oh, you catching the mic from Jersey disease. So yes.
I was, what something about what he said, and I lost it.
Okay, it's all right. See, Mike, when you talk, you forget what you're going to say, and then people hear you talk, and they forgot what you were going to say, and they forgot what they were going to say to what you said.
It's my mutant power, but I end up using it on myself.
There it is. All right, well, you have been listening to Night Shift. We are here Mondays from 10 p.m. till midnight here on listener-sponsored radio. You can, yeah, no, we're not gone yet, but I'm just letting people know what you're listening to. What were you going to say?
This idea of like the more wealthy or like affluent or settled individuals like carrying like the younger members of this union, I think that that's maybe not in a direct, you know, financial investment way of saying like, here, we'll pay your rent. But I do, and which happens, right? They're common funds, and that's what they're for. But I do think that in any union, in any organizing situation, there are always these senior members who you look to, these youngest people who have never been on strike, have never asked a corporation to represent them or support them in different ways, have always just signed contracts and showed up to work. I think that we always, in all of these situations, have these older members who do really carry in a lot of ways the momentum of the movement and sort of show by doing or teach by doing these younger folks. And so in a lot of ways, I do think these more established members are carrying this movement in that sense.
All right. I could buy that. I mean, sort of like Tom Cruise showing up for, you know, the negotiations.
I mean, also, wouldn't it arguably benefit him if he carried the actors?
Well, it benefits the whole industry. I mean, I feel like that. Let's put it this way. Yes, I do feel that they are going to support, I think, high profile actors, and they're already out there in the streets now. There's plenty of them who are out there protesting. So high profile.
So do you think someone like Tom Cruise, who I do literally think did save the industry with Top Gun with post-COVID revenue, that he could be a really big card to play?
Well, he already played a card. Just I guess earlier today or yesterday, he was at a negotiation. He showed up at a negotiation to as Dr.
So what's
Wright
your
said.
Prediction? When do you think it's going to end?
I don't know. It's a tough call. What's your take?
I honestly hope later rather than sooner. I mean, not to say I want these people out of work or struggling for longer, but I think that the longer they resist, the more effective it'll be.
Yeah, I agree. I think it'll, but I think it cuts both ways, unfortunately.
I think it's going to go into next year.
Yeah, I definitely think it'll be through the end of the year, at least. At least till the end of the year. That's my take. So. But this has been Night Shift, and how can people find you, Dr. Ray?
I am on Twitter and Instagram, and I'm easily Googleable. So you can just type Kelly Wright Linguist and get all of my stuff. But I'm at Ratio Linguistic, TIC on Twitter.
And what if people want to find you?
Like, you can reach me at my new email address.
You have a new email address?
Yes. You ready for this?
Is it scary? All right, I'm ready.
Focus Puller OG.
Focus Puller. Okay.
OG. At gmail.com.
That's your new?
Yes.
And why would they be emailing you? Just to...
Just do it or don't.
Or don't. Okay. All right. I love it. Okay. So, until... just do it or don't. Email him or don't. Well, you can email us here, and you can make a pledge, too. You can make a pledge in the name of Night Shift. You can call 212-209-2925. I'm sorry, 2950. That's 212-209-2950. And make a pledge in the name of Night Shift. You can become a WBAI buddy. That would be fantastic. I'd say $30 a month. For a year?
Yeah, that's... BAI, buddy. For a year? That's for a year. Like
that's
nothing.
It. That's nothing. It's nothing. You can do it twice. You can do it for yourself and somebody else as a gift. So, make a pledge in the name of Night Shift right now. Or you can
do it for my birthday.
That's right. Do it for her birthday. So, by the way, happy birthday. Okay, so are you doing anything besides being on Night Shift? Are you doing anything special?
Starting the day with Night Shift.
Yes.
Starting the day with Night Shift. What else could I want? No, I'm just gonna like eat a cake.
Eat a cake.
Maybe
eat
run
like
to the
an
mountain.
Entire cake.
What cake are you doing?
It's a chocolate cake white icing. You know, very classic birthday cake.
Did you buy it? Was it made for you? Did you make it yourself?
I did buy it, and I, you know, because I am going to be old, I asked them to write my name on it. And Scotty.
In what?
So there you go.
In what?
They wrote my name on it. Oh, I like it's very birthday cake, so I'm excited.
Okay, all right. I thought you said it. They wrote it they wrote your name in Klingon or something. I hope that you
have... It is a good day to die.
It is a good day. It's a good day to be born. So I want to say happy birthday. I'm glad you came on and did the show with us.
Mazel tov.
Mazel tov. And is it warm out there where you are? Is it hot?
Because it's hot in New York. It's still like 85 in the dark.
85 in the dark. That's pretty much what it is here. What's temperature, Mike, in Jersey? Do you know?
I believe it is 80 something.
Come on, this is the radio. You're supposed to give out this information right away. You're supposed to have it. It's 81 right now, partly cloudy. Okay? 81 and partly cloudy
I'm
here
getting
in New York.
77.
All right. It's 81. Okay. Where it's 77.
It's warmer in your side of the studio, Mike.
It's colder in Manhattan.
All right. Well, in New York. What'd you say?
It's warmer on your side of the studio.
Yeah, it's warm. Exactly. It's I'm on the hot side. It's 81 over here. So... All right, so until next time, this has been Night Shift, and we are here every week, Mondays from 10 p.m. till midnight, and life continues to be like science fiction.
Thank you for having me, Mike.
Thank you for having me. Thank you for joining us, Dr.
Yeah, it was good to talk to you, Mike.
And Mike from Jersey, too. Right?
Mike so, and Mike.
Thank you.
Mike and the fake Mike.
Mike and the fake.
I met him.
Starring Clint.
passion. Oh, Buddhas of the past, present, and future, Bodhisattvas, an ocean of measureless qualities, please hear my anguished words of truth. Karma.